Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for being here today. And thank you to Nir and everyone from the Bridgewater team for making the trip to join us. I'll start with a quick word on who we are and what the CAMEL is, and then we'll get right into things. Just a show of hands, how many people here have been to a CAMEL event before? Okay, good number, and some new people. So for those of you who don't know, we started the CAMEL 2 years ago with a very simple mission, which was to bring in the best Jewish and Israeli founders, entrepreneurs, business leaders to come to Harvard and MIT, meet with students, and for them to hear your guys' stories and for you guys to be able to talk to them. As many of you know, our events are open to everyone, and we usually have at least one speaker event a week. So if you're here, you're on the mailing list, which is great. I'm proud to say that over 2,000 Harvard and MIT undergrads have come to a CAMEL event since we first started, and I'm happy that you're all among them. Nir, when we first started the organization, I remember on day one, we said that we would know that we had done something right if we were able to get Nir Bardea, an Israeli leading the biggest the biggest hedge fund in the world to campus. So we're really honored to have you here today, and thank you so much for doing this.
Thrilled to be here.
I'll give everyone, I'm sure you all know, but I'll just remind everyone that Nir Bardea is the CEO of Bridgewater, a position which he's served since 2022. He sets and drives the company's strategic goals and oversees its day-to-day management. Nir's a partner, a member of the board of directors, chairs the executive committee, and is a member of the operating committee. In February 2021, Nir was appointed deputy CEO, leading Bridgewater's transition from founder Ray Dalio, and establishing key decision-making committees that continue to guide the firm's strategic and operational management today. He began his Bridgewater career in the research department, driving transformative initiatives with leadership that led to the creation of the firm's investment engine, which he rose to oversee, and the formation of the firm's current-day investment committee, which governs investment strategy and decisions. Nir currently serves on the global board of Global Citizen, which focuses on eradicating extreme poverty worldwide. Nir's also on the board of Robinhood, which works to alleviate poverty in New York City. He's a member of the Atlantic Council's International Advisory Board, which contributes to global security and policy initiatives. Nir received his MBA from Wharton and his bachelor's degree in finance from the Interdisciplinary Center at IDC Herzliya. In 2020, he was named one of Fortune's 40 under 40 in finance. So I guess we can calculate from that you're not that old. Nir, I want to get right into it. You're the CEO of Bridgewater. Your most important job, and tell me if I'm wrong, is understanding where the world is headed. So tell us, where are we headed?
Okay. So first of all, seriously, it's great to be here. Let's make sure that we get to a good back and forth with all of you. So we'll make time for questions. And the goal is really to make sure that we give you all what you need, so both in the conversation, and I'll try to stick around a little bit later and come talk to me. I get a lot from it. We just had a conversation with a handful of people from CAMEL, which was really, honestly, very meaningful to me. So please engage. To your question, look, I don't know what you guys know about Bridgewater, but let me start there and then try to hit the question on the head. The goal, Bridgewater is 50 this year. And you can describe Bridgewater in a lot of ways, but I think the most accurate way to talk about us is to think about an organization that said, hey, can we over time take the best people that we can find in the world and the best of technology and put them together to try to build the most unique and deep understanding of how the world works? It's a super, super ambitious goal, right? No one human brain can possibly fathom all the different things that are evolving and moving to understand how the world works. This would drive economies, it would drive markets. If you do that, you can monetize that in many, many ways. That's been the mission over a very, very long period of time. So that means that we always have a thesis about what's going on. And I'll say this. We believe that we are now in the midst of probably the most radical change that the world is going to go through in all of our lifetime. The type of change that happens probably once in more than 100 years. And it's important to look at that through the lens of history because a lot of things happen over and over and over again. So I'll talk about that in a second. And I do, and I want to make time in this conversation to also talk about what is our role in kind of going through that change. So to describe the change quickly and put it in a historical context, I'd say this. One way to cut what's happening right now is with simple two secular arcs that you will recognize. One is we are in the midst of a shift in the global order in the macroeconomic paradigm. Since the Second World War, we have been on this ride, right, of globalization. Efficiency was at the center of everything. Cooperation, it's been unbelievable. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. Because of how that played out, meaning who won from that and who lost from that, change has come. And there's basically a complete 180 in that macro paradigm. We went from that globalization framework to what we Aboriginal call modern mercantilism. I know some of you have mentioned that to me earlier, so you're aware of it. But what that means at its essence is we're moving to a nationalist world. Instead of cooperation, me first. Protectionism. This is where tariffs come from. Instead of efficiency, self-sufficiency. I don't want to be dependent on you. Remember in COVID when you wanted to get toilet paper? They're like, well, the ship has not come, or you can't build this table. People are like, no more of that. That is a complete rewiring of the global order that goes well beyond just the economy. So that's one wild change that is happening, and it's happening at the fastest rate that we've ever seen any policy change happening in the world ever. The second thing that's happening at the same time is that we're going through probably the largest technological disruption that we're going to see in our lifetime. And I'm putting aside, I'm sure many people have different views about how AI is going to play out over time from a productivity perspective. Like, how big is that chip going to be and where is it going to hit? Let's put that conversation aside for a second. Today, right now, we're in the middle of the biggest investment cycle that we have ever seen in the history of recorded economies. The biggest companies and countries in the world are spending like their lives depend on it. It's already driving geopolitics, right? The tension between China and the US. It's driving local politics. It's definitely driving any price of any asset, from the price of money to the price of equities to the price of currencies. You can't understand anything if you don't understand the wild thing that is happening with the investment cycle. And this is before this hits productivity and society. So take those two things and reflect on them for a second. Ask yourself, when was the last time the world has gone through such a non-cyclical change? And this is what I want you to think about. I would say the last time we saw one of those was probably somewhere around the 1930s. Right? What happened in the 1930s is we had disenfranchised people and disenfranchised nations making political choices to say, we want to change this world order. This is not working for me. I want something else in this. The backdrop was a technological arms race for nuclear technology. It ended up with a Second World War, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Eventually, the disarmament of Germany and Japan, Bretton Woods, and the beginning of the period that ends now. What's happening now? Disenfranchised people within nations, disenfranchised nations, think about why people are making political choices. It said that system that started back then is not working for me. I want something else. The backdrop is technological arms race that, just like the previous one, promises world dominance. Germany and Japan that disarmed back then are rearming now for the first time at the fastest rate that we have ever seen in the history of a country rearming, except, let's call it, World War II. And how this is going to end up, is it going to end up in a world war, is it going to end up in another 100 years of prosperity, is really the big question that's up to us.
But so let me throw that one back at you. I mean, you told us where we are now, comparing it to Germany and Japan, but in terms of where we're heading, how do you see it? What's going to be different this time than in those past transformations?
Good. So, I mean, the thing that is important for me to say, because everybody wants simple messages and it's easy. Everybody loves saying, you know, this is exactly like this or this is exactly like that year. What I'm saying, when I'm comparing it to the 1930s, I'm comparing it on dimensions that I said. There are many, many things that are different. And actually, if you work like we do it, mapping a deep understanding of how the world works, you see there are vast differences. The biggest difference that I would point to is who is going to manage this crisis. So there's a saying that I love that says that hard times lead to strong people lead to good times create weak people create hard times. I think we're pretty weak. I think we've been living in a super good time, unprecedented good time. And if you think about who managed that crisis in the 30s, let's think through that together for a second. And we can go all the way 250 years and say revolutionary America, people were super poor. You're probably a farmer. People are trying to recruit you to militias. If you get away from it and they catch you, you get executed. If you live until 1850, if you're a woman, you don't vote and you can't own property. If you're black, you are somebody else's property. The average life expectancy is below 40. But let's take the person who was born in 1900, because they managed that crisis in the 30s. That person, when they're a teenager, the Spanish flu is hitting, killing 30 million people. If they survive that, they're being shipped to the First World War. They're coming back like, okay, this was a tough couple of decades. They're like, no, Great Depression, Second World War. By the time Bretton Woods comes, think about what that person lived in, being right about your age or the age of your parents. What have they seen? How much resilience have they built? They set up these people that have went through the toughest things, create good times, set up the new world order. And even then, by the way, the beginning, 50s, 60s, Vietnam, assassination of Martin Luther King, JFK. You know when it starts to get really good? End of the 80s, beginning of the 90s, 2000s. It is unbelievably awesome. Anything you do here in America is just great. Stock market's up, economy's up, American exceptionalism. All of you were born into that. Your parents were born into that. None of us has seen a fraction of what it took to create the resiliency that led to the level of prosperity that happened for us. So the biggest difference, to answer your question, the biggest thing I'm worried about is the strength and resilience of the generation that is going to decide how we come out of the other end of the change that we're already going through.
So judging based off that, and tell me if I'm wrong, it sounds like we're the weak and not resilient generation. I should tell you, Harvard's cracking down on grade inflation next year, so we're gonna be the tough generation. But you know, on a more serious note, I mean, so what do we do about it? What's the solution?
Yeah, honestly, so I really believe, I would say, I am the weak generation. My hopes are that you will not be. And I'll say something simplistic. We can get into more tangible examples because I want to make it real. But look, the only way through this is for you guys to think independently about whether you truly believe what I'm saying. First, do you truly believe that we are in one of those 1 in 100 years changes that are going to happen? Do you believe that? You got to work through that. And if you believe that, do you truly believe that what it takes to come out of the other end of that into a better world, not a worse world, is a generation of the type that I'm describing? You got to work yourself through that. And if you believe both those things, what I'm asking you to do is unimaginable, right? Despite being the luckiest people ever, no one in the history of humans is more lucky than you, right? You're born in the right time, the right country. If you're here at Harvard or MIT, you're born to the right families. Even, by the way, if your life circumstances, you're probably thinking, wow, you don't know my life circumstances. Because some of you, I'm sure, have been dealt a harder hand than others. Maybe you're sick. I'm sorry. Seriously, I take that very seriously. Maybe your socioeconomic background is tough. You are still wildly better off than any other version of you facing the same circumstances than any time in history. And I'm asking you to do the unimaginable, which is instead of taking the infinite off-ramps to the easy paths that have been created for you, to take the other turn and to take the hard paths that leads to progress. And I know it's tough, and that's why you have to start with asking yourself, what do you fundamentally believe about the point that we are in the world and what it will take to get us a better place?
So, I mean, I'm curious, it's interesting to hear you say, you know, can you take the hard path? And I'd want to ask you, you know, if there's specific examples of that that would come to mind. I mean, particularly, you know, I think that there were a lot of people that tell us, you know, that the easy path is finance and consulting, you know, and obviously you're the CEO of Bridgewater. So, you know, what do you actually mean when you say that we should choose the hard path?
I'll just tell you that we are also cracking on great inflation, so it's not that easy. I'll try to share a lot here so it feels like it's being brought down, and also share things that are hard and controversial. So I'll give a couple of examples and then have to talk through any of them. So I'm Israeli. Born and raised in Israel, third generation of Holocaust survivors. And there's all, at the age of 18 in Israel, you need to go to mandatory military service. Relevant for this story also, that I am definitely at the age of 18, I'm liberal. On the political spectrum of Israelis back then, 90s, I'm 44 by the way, supporting the late Prime Minister Rabin, and then later the left wing in Israel, pro two states, you get to this military service, and now you have to make some choices about easy and hard paths. Let me give you two examples. One, you have to choose, and there's somebody here in the audience that has served in the military with me, to keep me honest, you have to make the choice about, do I want to be close to the conflict, or do I want to be far from the conflict? You have all these opinions on the conflict. Do you want to be close to where life and death decisions are being made, or do you want to be far away from them? Do you want to do that for 3 years, or do you want to volunteer to be an officer and be in that situation for longer? You would say on its face, look, if you're liberal and if you're on the left side of the political spectrum, why don't you choose to be away from the places that are going to torment you and shorten that to the shortest period of time that you can possibly do? And one of the best decisions that I made in my life was to do the opposite, because the fundamental thinking was, there's a reason why I would be tormented putting myself in that situation. And do I want the people that are making those decisions to be tormented by them? Or do I want the people that are extremely happy to be in that situation making those decisions? And if I do, what reality do I think will then prevail? And it's an example that happens in all of our lives. And so I've ended up putting myself in, I think, one of the toughest situations for a very long period of time. And I'll say two things about that. One, it was harder than I ever imagined it would be. The torment was harder than I ever imagined it would be. But I also deeply believe that it caused radically better outcomes than what could have happened otherwise in many other scenarios. And I've learned that I can take it, that I can be tormented and enjoy it. And if I do that in the right places, it leads to great outcomes. I'll give another example. And I think for many of you are going to be in leadership positions. This is going to sound generic, but it's the truth. And it happens all the time and more in today's world. Look, if you're a leader, almost always there's one of two decisions, and there's Bridgewater employees here. So, you know, I hope you stomach this. There's the popular decision that you can make, and there's the right decision that you can make. The correlation between them is either zero or negative. Because most people don't want to be told hard things. They don't want to do the hard thing. They would, and by the way, more and more in today's world, right? We talked about a full generation that has enjoyed such prosperity that people are just like, just give me more goodness. Think about, by the way, speeches of presidents from 100 years ago. When Roosevelt is talking about the man in the arena, the blood and the sweat, or when Kennedy is talking about doing things because they're hard, not because they're easy, that's not the political lingo today. Today, they're promising you great things. It's going to be great. It's going to be amazing. By the way, left and right, it's just going to be awesome. And you're like, give me more of that, please. Don't tell me it's going to be hard. Tell me it's going to be easy. Same for my employees. And you can get that satisfaction immediately and that popularity immediately. So take 2022. Roe v. Wade gets overturned. I'm a CEO of a company that recruits here. We're in Connecticut, New York. You can imagine the vast majority of what the employees at Bridgewater believe and think, what beliefs they hold. The second that thing happens, I get dozens and dozens of emails that are very clear about what I'm expected to do. Denounce the Supreme Court. Denounce anybody that supports the ruling of the Supreme Court as anti-human rights. And so on and so forth, in a way that I could write that email in 2 minutes. And not only am I going to be super popular with my employees, the New York Times is also going to freaking love it. And I'll be a hero for a day. The problem is that if you run an organization that tries to get to a true understanding of how the world works, one of the things you want the most is people that hold deeply different beliefs that are willing to engage each other on them, on many topics. And if you're getting a lot of those emails, you might have a problem in your org. And they're actually reflective of a weakness, not because those people are not amazing, by the way, and my personal beliefs could be completely aligned with theirs. Because you also want people that think something different. And there clearly are many of them. And they're just not here, or they're afraid to speak. So what I end up doing is the thing that was very easy. We always had very extensive benefits around abortions, and we extended them to be cross-state. That was important, but easy. And by the way, populist, it's also costless. But in my communication to the company on the day after, the most important thing I believe I did was to say, hey, if you're disheartened and devastated today, I get it. I'm here, I understand it. By the way, if you're happy today, if this is what you have longed for a long time, I get that also. And you belong here just as much. I lost all the celebration and the positive emails got lost that day. But if you play that forward to regime changes, when you go from one side of the political spectrum to the other, which is what happened, and you just ask yourself, what kind of org did you build? You made the hard decision, you took pain, but you got yourself to a better place. And I'll say one last thing on that, which I think is so, so important as an extension, and it's a good reflection of Bridgewater, and I think where Harvard failed, for what it's worth, for a long time, is in that, right? In this idea of to get better, there's inherent pain, we believe. I'm not talking about the type of learning that you open a textbook and you're like, ooh, I never knew this, this is cool. That's crap learning. The hard learning is I really believed in something so deeply about myself, I thought I'm X, or about something that I cherish in my set of beliefs, and I'm holding so closely to it, and somebody is threatening it. Somebody has questions about Israel. Somebody has questions about the Palestinians. Somebody has questions about Roe v. Wade. Opening those things up scare us. Discovering that we're wrong on these things is super painful. And what happens over time, because we try to avoid pain, is we start to surround ourselves with people that mostly agree with us on the most important things to us. We take the caricature of the other side, because it's easy to then further validate what we think, and we learn nothing, and we make zero progress. At the heart of Bridgewater, if the idea is to understand how the world works, is to constantly put ourselves in that pain. To constantly look for the deepest disagreements and the people that the one thing they share is that they really want to learn, and they're willing to let go even of things that really scare them. And man, just imagine we can have our higher education institutions do the same.
I'm curious though to ask you again on for people our age, as we're deciding in this era of huge transformation, what do we actually do next with our lives? I mean, how would you apply that? How would you apply that advice as we're thinking? What's our path? Where are we going to live? What are we going to do? What do we want to commit ourselves to?
Well, I can't answer that generally, meaning that it really depends on, I'm going to avoid this question the following way. Just because I think the biggest disease that I've seen, I've started Bridgewater as an intern. I know 44 seems like super old to you guys, but I feel like you're basically my age. Just let me hold on to that until the end of the night. And one of the things that I know I can tell you today is most of the direct advice you're getting is full of shit. People take their individual experience, and luck, by the way, and extrapolate theories from it that are generally true. Well, you know, if this worked for me, therefore everybody is going to live this life. And I think that is much more harmful than helpful. I wouldn't trust a lot of things that I'm saying generally because they're subjective and they're only my experience. And two, I don't know what it's like to be you or what it's like to be you. I don't know what you want to do. I don't know what you're like. I don't know where you are at your best. So the biggest thing I'm telling you guys is take the examples that I gave when you're facing that crossroad and you know that torturing yourself is actually good for the outcome and for you. When you know you're choosing the generic path because it's more money or it's gonna be better in your college reunion or it's gonna be translated better on social media versus what you really actually believe deep down inside. If you really wrestle with it, with those things and you take the hard paths, whatever they are for you, which is not what society is doing generally, we all are basically choosing the other option, I think you'll live a more meaningful life and we'll all be together in a much better off place.
Comparing the era that we are now to 1930s Germany, not that it's, you know, a perfect comparison, but the analogies, I mean, do you think that there's reason to be hopeful? I mean, what are you optimistic about as you look towards the next couple of years and decades?
Yeah, and I just want to be clear. The comparison is not, I'm not saying Holocaust. I am saying a new world order. The world reorganizes itself. Germany was a piece of that. Japan was a piece of that. The U.S. was a piece of that. A lot was happening back then that started a whole new operating system. And I'll say this, look, if you're listening to what I'm saying and you're like, man, this is dark and I'm super worried and it's depressing, I would say that's a reflection of us, not of the objective reality. Because what I said also is, like, no one's been luckier than us in the history of mankind. Like, go to the bathroom, wash your face, look in the mirror, and say, man, I really won the lottery. How the hell am I riding this wave in such a beautiful way? And then look in the mirror and say, one, I should be grateful for the strong people that created this unbelievable stretch for us. And the second thing you should be saying is, what am I doing to create that for future generations? And because I think if you went in a time machine and you said, take me back to any period in time, you will struggle to find a point that you would look at the horizon and you would say, the horizon is less scary than what it is now. This is what the world is like. The world is constantly going through these things. It's just a matter of what does the generation do to navigate them. So if there's any room for pessimism, it's not about the objective circumstances. It's about what we are like and what we're going to do with them. And this is where I honestly feel like you guys are way more the hope than us. Like you actually suffering from what's happening right now, the folks that I just talked to that went through hell as Jews and Israelis on campus, how is that building their character? Are they leaning into it or out of it? Are they trying to stop that pain or are they saying, no, I need more of that. Like, let me put me in the toughest positions because that's going to build the resilience. It's going to build the character. It's going to build the solutions. It's going to create a better time.
I think that's a great note on which to open it up. To everyone. We have no, you know, we're not planting questions. We really want to hear from you. Nir wants to be challenged. Wanna split both sides of the room. Yeah, in the back there.
Hi, my name is Nate. I'm at Harvard studying econ and art history. I wanted to ask a question about the very first thing you said about the changing world order and how we're moving towards this nationalism and new mercantilism. And I guess, you know, when you look at some of the misadventures with tariffs or Greenland, you kind of get that picture. But then at the same time, you hear what people like Secretary Rubio say in Munich, where they're talking about, you know, the shared culture of the West that America's built on the same foundations as Europe and the Western world. So I guess, you know, how do you square the circle on that? Like, on one sense, you know, you have this idea that America is being more nationalistic, almost jingoistic. And then the other side is, you know, America's willing to accept the Western world, shares this foundation, shares this culture, but they're not willing to accept, you know, the managed decline of Europe, mass migration, overregulation, all of that. And so, you know, maybe what our leaders are doing is, like what you said, taking the hard path instead of the easy one, but it's actually sort of the tough love that they're trying to create that's, you know, a vision that's not so nationalistic, but actually embracing sort of the shared culture, shared values that the West has.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I hope is clear. I'm saying what it is. We are moving to a mercantilist framework. I wasn't saying that's necessarily a negative thing. Let's talk about that for a second. So let me argue your argument, which I totally agree with. This is, again, if you're really just trying to understand how things work, put your opinions aside for a second, just understand how it works. Is we had globalization, massive overall increase of the pie. That happened through the gutting of the manufacturing base in the US. Literally. We can manufacture this more cheaply, move it to China, move it to Vietnam. The pie grew significantly. And then if you look at the complexion of the population in the US, if you have, I don't know where, I'm sure there are people here from different parts of the US where your parents, if not you, have seen your towns get eaten alive. But the removal of anything that is manufacturing in the US, people that were saying, wait, the pie is getting bigger where? Not here. And again, what I said about COVID is real. The interdependence between countries about critical supply chains, I was joking about the tables, but it's not just tables. Think about AI chips. It's a real freaking thing. I was not arguing that we should continue what has happened. There's good reason why a democratic system is saying, I said disenfranchised people that said this is not working for them, it's real. I talk to Scott Bessent frequently. He says we are moving to a mercantilist America First framework. So I do think they think they're taking the hard path. I think in some ways they are. In some ways they're taking a populist path. But I wasn't trying to say this was wrong or right. I'm just saying this is what it is. You have to understand what it is, and it's definitely going to create the fact that Rubio, what happened to Rubio? Everything hit a boiling point in Davos this year. I'm sure many of you have kind of followed Carney's speech, but with Greenland, there was like an inflection point where it felt like the Europeans and the Canadians were saying, enough. Enough. And China was coming into the picture because now in a world that is fragmented, everything is up to play, right? What Carney said in his speech, he said, hey, you know, maybe China's a better partner. Rubio is doing something very pragmatic and is trying to signal, hey, yes, America first. Yes, we're moving to this world. In between these options, I think you want to be on our side. We'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, back there.
Hi, Nir. I'm Tatiana. I'm a senior at MIT. I wanted to say, first of all, I'm really grateful that you aren't giving us advice on how to live our lives. I think that's something that I really appreciate, and I know that for a lot of us, we do live different lives. But I did want to ask you two questions. In the sense of, obviously, everyone is different, what do you think for you makes you uniquely qualified to be a CEO at a finance company, especially Bridgewater? And also, do you have any advice for how to figure out what makes us uniquely qualified for different fields, also how to find those fields. I think as we become graduates and trying to understand like what our skill sets are and where they fit, it is a little bit difficult to explore that. So how do you think that your skill sets fit and how did you find that?
So there's a lot of parts to that. Let me start with the biggest gift I think I could give, which is I am not sure I am the best person for my job, honestly. And I have self-doubts. And I have points of insecurity. And you have them too. And it's okay. And if you don't have them, something's wrong with you probably. I'm not kidding. Be wary of the people that don't have them. In the good moments, I would have said the thing, and I just said this to somebody who knows me for many years, the thing that helped me was that I was dramatically less successful than you guys at your age. I really struggled in school. I didn't graduate high school. I thought I was, and I think everybody thought I was an idiot. When I did, so much so, and this is like a good lens into a Jewish mother, so much so that when, the good thing about Israel, because it was a melting pot where people came from everywhere in the world, is that the military is built to basically give you a fresh start. So you don't get Ashkenazi Jews versus Jews that came from Africa, kind of fundamentally disadvantaged. The military tests you from scratch, and I test in the military after school tells me you're an idiot, and the army says, wait, not so much. And I go into a flight academy, and I have a pretty successful military career, but when I eventually do my SATs and I get a nearly perfect score, I bring this to my mom, and my mom is like, there must be a mistake. That's all you got to know about a Jewish mom. But that path has built resilience, an ability to fail and not be afraid of it. It built courage. I don't need to be liked. I don't need to be celebrated. Not today, by the way, it's creeping in. This is ruining the best parts of me in some ways. Really. Because it's the people that are like, look, I can take a punch and I'll get up. And I really don't care if you think I'm the best, that are most likely to do unbelievably great things. So going to the heart of your question, which is what I was trying to say in my previous answer, the most important thing, especially going into the change that we're going into, is to think hard about how you become a resilient human being. Take the hard paths. You have no idea where life is going to take you. If you think, man, you know, if I just master this skill, things are going to work out, I promise you, it might be true for one in 100 people, then other 99 will find out that life is wildly different than anything they've ever imagined. Their ability to be wrong. By the way, our ability at Bridgewater, to be wrong, to say, oh, shit, I was wrong. Let me go back and figure this out. Over and over and over and over again, far and away. And by the way, in career, in your personal life, in your relationships and friends, far and away, I think the most important thing that's going to help you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the front.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. My name is Rashika. I'm also a senior at MIT, and I'm studying AI and political science. And over the last year, I've noticed more and more similarities between like the traditional political science modeling I'm used to and modeling in financial institutions. So my question is related to AYA, the AI Associates Lab at Bridgewater, and more broadly, like how financial modeling is changing in this new age of AI.
This is a question for advanced people. So. Love it. So I'm going to say something about Bridgewater just to make so everybody can understand what we're talking about, and then I'll answer your question. Then if you want to go deeper, let's huddle on this. But so the idea of understanding how the world works, I said, look, just think about the amount of things you would want to be thinking about if you're mapping and understanding the world. So the idea at Bridgewater over 50 years was, I said, to use the best of technology, we build a model. There is a massive model that's been built over generations that literally tries to map everything. You can go into our systems, and it's an expert system that humans started the thinking of cause-effect linkages of how the economy works, and then we stress test that through time and countries, and if the relationship basically holds, we add it to a pile of understanding. That, by the way, for years, people thought we were insane to try to do that because of, like, that's not possible. Today, people are like, that seems like ancient ways to try to do things. But it was the platform that set the potential for AIA, meaning the idea that you can systemize and model things. And the art of doing that, it's hard. It's super hard. Was the platform upon which in 2018 we started this journey with AI. Greg Jensen, my partner who I think spoke here a couple of years ago, was the first round of investors in OpenAI. He was the first check to Anthropic. He's been on this journey for a long time. And the thing that was missing in our process of systemization, the thing that humans were uniquely capable of doing in understanding how the world works, I'm not talking about mathematic arbitrage or quant, is the ideation. Because what happens in macro is the data sample is small. It's not the amount of stock prices that you have. It's how many times, think about what we talked about here in the beginning, how many times did we have a change of world order of this type? Can you look at a data set, a time series, and say, well, this is what's happening? How many times has the currency been debased? You really have to reason. You have to transfer learn. You have to say, well, you're not going to find exactly one of these, but I can put these pieces together, and this is what's happening. That's a thing that's been uniquely, and still, by the way, uniquely human-enabled. AIA is the first crack of having machine learning ideates. And it does that through transfer learning, through a combination of a tabular model and language model that hypothesizes, tests the hypothesis, and kind of goes back and forth on these things. With the most profound breakthrough that I think we are seeing right now is how can you systemize and enter into your model unstructured data? Because that is the missing piece to anything that's not in the data series. And only humans could have done this until now. And now technology can do this better than any humans would ever be able to do it, if you're doing it well. Super hard. There's so much garbage out there. You can try to systemize unstructured data and get garbage. But if you're doing it well, you can actually ideate. So AIA is basically a fund that takes the entire process that I just described, where humans were ideating, but our expert systems were executing, competes with it through AI doing all of it. And they're going head to head. Last year, the humans won. Our main fund crushed it with 34% on the year, and AIA also finished in double digits. This year, AIA is way ahead so far. So it's fascinating.
My name is Robert. I'm a freshman at the college, Harvard. And I'm a big fan of everything that you guys do at Bridgewater. I'm curious, so obviously Ray Dalio is a big Sinophile, and he strongly believes that China is going to overtake the U.S. as the world's biggest superpower. Since Principles came out, the Shanghai Composite is returned approximately 12%, and the S&P has returned five times more than that. How much is it the conviction of the whole Bridgewater team that China is going to overtake the U.S. as the world's number one economy? How do you guys bet on it? And then how do you guys make sure that your bets are convex enough that if that doesn't materialize or it takes much longer to materialize, you still continue delivering the alpha that you guys do?
So Ray's views are Ray's views. They're not my views or our views, and I'm not sure Ray agrees with what you just said, but you should ask him. We don't have a belief that at any level nor have we ever had one, by the way, that China's going to overtake the U.S. I'll say what we do believe. We believe China is a super important part of any macro investor's, one, understanding, and two, portfolio. Meaning having allocation to China in a world where you're trying to be diversified is extremely important. And in almost every case, those portfolios are underweight. Meaning you can be long Chinese assets, not because you think China's going to overtake the U.S., just because you're looking at the pricing of Chinese assets, and you're like, whew, that is cheap, because no one's buying them. You know what's priced into American assets? When you're bullish U.S. assets, an example right now, the U.S. last 15 years were the best 15 years, you mentioned the S&P, that the S&P has ever seen in the history of time. Of any path you could describe, it's the single best path that could have happened. You know what's priced into the next 15 years? A better path. It's going to be even better. You know what that means? That means that the U.S. is going to, it's already, to just to maintain these prices, has to eat the rest of the world, because just by the economic activity that's happening in the U.S., that's not going to be enough to uphold these prices. It's taking the profits from Europe. In today's world, think about Rubio and what's happened, the geopolitical environment. Do you think the Europeans are going to be like, you should keep eating my lunch. I'm going to send my money over to... So you don't have to be... You don't have to be extreme to say, hey, and by the way, the exact opposite dynamic in China. Everybody has been staying away from China. The money has been flowing to the U.S. You have cash flows that can be happening in China that are discounted wildly. You don't have to have an extreme view of China's going to overtake the U.S. to be like, it is smart to invest in China. And on that point, our fund in China has returned more than 30% last year and in the year before. More than the S&P in some cases, more than our funds in the US, for what it's worth. Because if you're a smart investor in China and you understand these dynamics, it's a good market not only to have returns onshore or in markets that benefit from it, but also a great way to just diversify the portfolio. So one last thing on China and where I do think China's winning. And again, opinions aside, we talk about modern mercantilism. Who was the first and biggest mercantilist economy in the world? Who were the people that when everybody said globalization, 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 they said, screw you, I have national interests. I'm not doing that. China first. We laughed for a long time. We're all playing China's game now. Again, judgment aside, just what's happening.
We're running out of time, so I want to ask you one last question, and I wonder if this could be on some other people's minds as well. Obviously, you spoke about being Israeli, and you know, I think that it's no secret that Israel is a complicated country. You know, on the one hand, you have the highest startup rate per capita in the world, one of the highest in the world, even if you don't say per capita, despite being a country of 10 million people. On the other hand, you have conflict that's gone on for almost 80 years now. Israel is very unpopular in some circles, some parts of the world. How do you wrestle with sort of the, on the one hand, you know, you credited the military with some of where you've gotten to today. On the other hand, you have sort of a very messy situation. How do you wrestle with those two different sides of what it is to be Israeli today?
I don't wrestle with what it's like being Israeli. I'm proud of everything that I am, and what I am is complicated. I'm also an American. I'll say this, and it's more than I've ever said about this topic, because I think it's been true to the, just take the hard path. I don't know what people's opinions are here. I know that a lot of people in Harvard have a deep disdain, certainly for Israel, and maybe for Israelis, and maybe for Jews, and some of it is well-earned for what it's worth. Some of it is purely anti-Semitic and racist, and you can imagine the amount of hate mail, social media accounts that I get. There's conspiracy theories about everything from me being a murderer to seriously, to me being the leader of a grand conspiracy to debase the US dollar. So I've been in this argument many times, and the thing that is easiest for me, especially as an Israeli that knows the material and the head of an organization that does deep research, I can win most of those arguments. And it feels good. It feels good. It feels so good to get the other person on their back feet. The problem is it gets you nowhere. It gets you nowhere. So let me do the opposite. You know, the best version of myself, which is not always the version that comes out. Sometimes there is a bad version of me. But the best version of myself takes the person who thinks so fundamentally different than me on this topic and says to him, look, I understand your argument. Let me make your argument for you. Start from the Bible or the biblical time, the Quran. Muslims were in Israel 1,000 years ago. When the Jews have left, they were there. And in 1917, when the Balfour Declaration happened, I get it that you say, hey, who the hell are the British that are occupiers themselves to give the Jews this land? Who are you to do that? And in 1947 and 48, so many people became refugees because they were pushed out of their homes. And in 1967, Israel started a war, ended up occupying the West Bank and Gaza. And then even when there were conversations about peace, they fell short of a full country because they never wanted to give a full military to the Palestinian people. And then October 7th happened with a war that killed tens of thousands of Palestinians. The best version of myself starts there and says, I get it. Those things are true, and they're hard, and I want to understand more. But it's not the full story. Let me tell you my side and what I'm feeling. 4,000 years ago, there were Jews in Jerusalem. 3,000 years ago, King David already built the sacred house. If you want to go to 1917, the Balfour Declaration, the smallest minority in the world, for the first time, got the international community to say you're going to have a home somewhere. It's going to be here. And then 1947, the UN Resolution 181 said we're going to split the land. You guys can have these people that just fled the Holocaust and came with nothing. You can have this piece of land. The rest is going to go to your neighbors. And these people were attacked. And that's how the refugees happened. And yes, 67 happened, but then 73 happened. And in 73, you started the war, and you lost. And when Prime Minister Rabin was trying to create a two-state solution, I was in Dizengoff Center when bombs exploded and killed my friends, trying to stop a peace process that was trying to give the Palestinians a state. And the same thing happened with Ehud Barak, and the same thing happened with Sharon, and the same thing happened with Olmert. And October 7th was the single biggest massacre of Jews in recorded history. And by the way, if you want to take the tragedy, which is a massive tragedy of the tens of thousands of people that died in Gaza, you got to compare that on a base to the wars that were fought by this country. The ratio of military targets to non-military targets is dead center. More people died in Iran a month ago in one day. Nobody seemed to care. 3x died in Afghanistan, 3x died in Iraq. You know, if you care about indigenous people, billions of Muslims, billions of Christians, Hindus, Chinese all have many countries, 15 million Jews, one country. It's as dense as taking the entire population of the United States and shoving it in Texas. And say, let's split the land. Do you feel what I'm feeling? I feel what you're feeling. Do you feel what I'm feeling? And that person will say back to me, hey, Nir, but you guys are a superpower. In the Middle East, there's so many disenfranchised people suffering around you, and he's right. The only way to have this conversation is for me to think hard about all those first points and feel them in my heart and seek to understand them and find the people that want to do the same in return. And don't give up on it. Don't give up on it. Even if the conversation starts with, I just want to surround myself with people that are saying just one half of the story. I just want to listen to this. It feels so freaking good. I want to yell it. I want to shout it. Keep trying. Keep trying. Because it might feel good, but it's the easy path. It will lead to zero progress. So at my best, I do that. And when it works, it's painful and it feels amazing. Bridgewater, 20% of our clients are Middle Eastern. And it's been a life-changing experience having these conversations with people that feel as passionately about the first part of the arguments that I've made as I do about the second part of the arguments that I made, but love me, and I love them. And I just wish we had a lot more of that.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.